A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He's thinking about the tension we all feel around plastic. We hate buying it, but for home storage and organization, it's often the only game in town. His argument is that the least destructive move might be to buy better plastic that actually survives your use case. Bins where the lids don't crack after two winters, where the sidewalls don't split when you pull them off a garage shelf. The question is, if you're shopping for that kind of quality, what exactly are you looking for on the spec sheet and in the plastic type itself?
This is where most people give up, because the information is technically printed on the product. It's right there. But nobody teaches you how to read it.
The plastic bin you bought last year has a cracked lid. The one your grandparents bought in 1987 is still fine. What did they know that you don't?
They knew, or the manufacturer knew, that plastic isn't one material. It's a family of materials, and the difference between a bin that dies in 3 years and one that lasts 20 is almost entirely in the spec sheet. Not the brand name, not the price tag alone, not the vague heavy-duty sticker on the front. The spec sheet.
Let's talk about how to read one. Because this isn't about avoiding plastic. That ship has sailed for anyone who needs stackable modular storage. It's about buying the right plastic once instead of cheap plastic 5 times.
The failure modes are predictable. They're not random defects. When a lid cracks along the hinge line, when the corner of a bin splits after a 3-foot drop, when a clear bin in the garage turns chalky and shatters in your hands, those are material science failures. Specific things went wrong with specific polymers at specific points in the manufacturing process, and you can avoid almost all of them if you know 3 things: the resin type, the additive package, and the processing method.
Resin type, additives, processing. Those are the 3 categories that matter. Everything else is marketing.
The resin type, that's the polymer family. And you've seen the little triangle with the number on the bottom of every plastic container. Most people think that recycling code tells them where to put it in the blue bin. It actually tells you what the material is, and that's where the durability story starts. For storage bins, you're really only looking at 2 numbers, 2 and 5, HDPE and polypropylene.
Number 5. Polypropylene is the most common bin material by far. What makes it work for bins specifically?
Polypropylene has excellent fatigue resistance, which is a very specific property. Fatigue resistance means it can bend repeatedly without breaking. That's why living hinges, those thin strips of plastic that connect a lid to a bin, are almost always made of polypropylene. You can flex them thousands of times, and the polymer chains just keep springing back. But here's the catch. And this is where most people get burned. Not all polypropylene is the same. There are 2 major types, homopolymer PP and copolymer PP. Homopolymer is just propylene molecules chained together. It's stiff, it's cheap, it molds easily, but it's brittle, especially at low temperatures. Copolymer PP, sometimes labeled PPC or PP impact copolymer, has rubber particles dispersed through the polymer matrix. Little bits of ethylene propylene rubber mixed in at the molecular level.
It's polypropylene with rubber shock absorbers built in.
That's exactly what it is, and the numbers are staggering. Homopolymer PP has a notched Izod impact strength. That's the standard test for how much energy a material absorbs before cracking, of about 20 to 50 joules per meter at room temperature. Copolymer PP with 15 to 20% rubber content can exceed 500 joules per meter. That's a 10 times improvement in impact resistance.
When you knock a bin off a shelf in February, the homopolymer one shatters. The copolymer one bounces.
That temperature part matters. Homopolymer PP gets dramatically more brittle as it gets cold. A bin that survived a drop in July will explode in January. Copolymer PP retains its impact resistance down to negative 20 Celsius or lower. This is why the IKEA Samla bin, which is homopolymer PP, has a reputation for cracking after a few garage winters. The really useful box, which is copolymer PP, doesn't.
Let's put some weight numbers on that. You mentioned the Samla versus the really useful box.
The IKEA Samla. The 50-liter version weighs about 680 grams. The really useful box 35-liter version weighs 1,800 grams. That's 2.6 times more material for a smaller volume. Some of that is wall thickness, but a lot of it is the additive package and the copolymer content. The really useful box is just denser, tougher material throughout.
The weight of the bin, just picking it up in the store, is already telling you something. More mass per liter of volume generally means more material, which generally means better durability.
It's not a perfect proxy. You can have a thick-walled homopolymer bin that's still brittle, but it's a strong first filter. If you divide the price by the weight in kilograms, and the cost per kilogram is under about $10, you're probably looking at thin-walled homopolymer.
We know the resin type matters, but the resin is only half the story. The additives hiding inside that plastic are what determine whether your bin survives its first winter in the garage.
And the most important additive for storage bins is UV stabilizers, specifically something called hindered amine light stabilizers, or HALs. Polypropylene is inherently vulnerable to ultraviolet light. UV photons break the polymer chains, and the material becomes chalky, weak, and brittle. In unstabilized PP, you lose about 50% of tensile strength after roughly 1,000 hours of direct sunlight. That's about 4 months in a south-facing garage window.
That's one summer.
One summer, and your bin is half as strong. HALS stabilizers extend that to 10,000 hours or more. That's years of indirect sunlight. And here's the thing. If the bin doesn't say UV stabilized or UV resistant on the spec sheet or the label, it almost certainly doesn't have HALS. It's an expensive additive. Manufacturers don't include it and then stay quiet about it.
UV resistant is something you want to see printed somewhere. If it's not there, assume the bin is an indoor-only product.
This connects to color. Clear bins have essentially no UV protection unless they're specifically formulated with HALS. Carbon black, the pigment used in black plastic, is itself a UV stabilizer. It absorbs UV before it can damage the polymer. So black bins, dark gray bins, dark green bins, they inherently last 3 to 5 times longer in sunlight than clear bins, even without HALS. If you add HALS to a black bin, it's practically immortal in normal use.
Of course there are. The black bin in your grandpa's garage that's been there since the Reagan administration.
And that's not an accident. The carbon black is doing real chemical work.
What about the other additives? Impact modifiers, flame retardants, all that?
Impact modifiers are the second big one. We already talked about the rubber particles in copolymer PP. That's ethylene propylene rubber, or EPR. But you can also add impact modifiers to other resins. The key visual cue is something called stress whitening. If you take the edge of a bin lid and flex it, just bend it a little, and you see a white line form at the bend point, that's actually a good sign. That whitening is the impact modifier doing its job. The rubber particles are cavitating. They're creating tiny voids that absorb energy and stop cracks from propagating. If you flex the lid and it just snaps immediately with no whitening, you're looking at homopolymer with no impact modifier.
The bend test is a field diagnostic. Flex the lid edge. Whitening equals tough. Immediate cracking equals brittle.
That's the quick and dirty test, and it works surprisingly well. Now, flame retardants, those are mostly irrelevant for storage bins, and they can actually reduce mechanical properties. If a bin advertises flame retardancy, it's probably not what you want for home storage. You're paying for an additive that makes the plastic weaker and more expensive for a fire scenario that's not your primary concern.
What about the food grade thing? I see people online assuming that food grade plastic means higher quality.
That's a major misconception. Food grade certification, like FDI 21 CFR 177.1520 for polypropylene, tests for chemical migration. It asks, will anything leach out of this plastic into your food? It does not test for mechanical durability at all. In fact, food-grade bins often use fewer impact modifiers because those rubber additives haven't been tested for food contact migration. So a food-grade bin may actually be less durable than an industrial bin made of the same resin.
Food-grade on the label is about your lunch, not about the bin's lifespan.
It's a safety certification, not a durability certification. Don't confuse them.
That explains why some bins crack and others don't. But what about the lid? The lid is where most bins fail first, and the design choices there tell you everything about the manufacturer's intent.
The lid is the canary, and the living hinge. That thin plastic bridge between the lid and the bin is the single most stressed part of any storage container. Polypropylene can survive a million flex cycles in copolymer form. In homopolymer, it's more like 1,000 to 10,000 cycles. That's 100 to 1,000 times difference. The hinge on a really useful box has 5 knuckles, 5 separate connection points, and the geometry is designed to distribute stress across all of them. A cheap bin might have 2 knuckles or a continuous hinge with no reinforcement. Every single design choice on the hinge predicts how long your lid stays attached.
5 knuckles versus 2. That's the kind of thing you can count with your eyes in the store.
Also look at the lid surface itself. Ribbed lids with cross bracing, those raised geometric patterns, are there for load stacking. They transfer weight from the bin above down through the sidewalls. A flat, thin lid with no ribbing is telling you this bin is not designed to be stacked with anything heavy on top of it.
The lid is basically a structural element. It's not just a cover.
In a good bin, the lid is part of the load path. In a bad bin, it's a dust cover that happens to snap on.
Let's talk about processing methods, because you mentioned injection molding versus rotomolding earlier.
Most consumer storage bins are injection molded. That means molten plastic is forced into a mold under high pressure. The problem with injection molding is weld lines. When plastic flows around a mold and meets itself on the other side, that meeting point, often at the corners, is a weak spot. The polymer chains don't fully entangle across that boundary. So injection molded bins tend to fail at the corners first. Rotomolding, rotational molding, is different. You put plastic powder in a mold, heat it, and rotate it in multiple axes. The plastic coats the inside of the mold evenly, and there are no weld lines. The wall thickness is uniform, and the corners are actually the strongest part because material pools there slightly.
Rotomolded bins don't have that built-in corner weakness.
But rotomolding is slower and more expensive, so it's rare in consumer storage. You see it in industrial bins, kayaks, large chemical tanks. Blow molding, which is common for large totes, is the third method. You inflate a tube of plastic inside a mold. The walls tend to be thinner, and stress cracking is more common because the polymer chains are oriented differently during the blowing process.
If you're buying a big tote for the garage, and it's blow molded, you should expect a shorter lifespan than a comparable injection molded bin.
All else being equal, yes. The wall thickness variation in blow molding creates weak points. It's fine for light storage, holiday decorations, bedding. But if you're loading it with tools or heavy items, you want injection molded or rotomolded.
We've covered the material science. Now let's talk about how to actually use this information when you're standing in the aisle at Home Depot or scrolling through Amazon.
The first thing to understand is that most consumer bins don't publish material data sheets. You're not going to find a PDF with tensile strength and ISOT impact numbers for a Sterilite bin, but you can infer a lot. Weight, as we said, heavier is generally better for the same volume. The mold number, there's usually a 6-digit number on the underside that identifies the tool used to make it. Newer tools produce more consistent parts with fewer defects, but you can't really date a mold from the number alone. Country of origin matters more than people think. German and Japanese molds typically use higher grade copolymer PP. Chinese molds vary enormously. Some are excellent, some are the cheapest possible homopolymer.
Made in Germany on a plastic bin actually means something specific about the polymer grade.
German manufacturers, companies like Auer Packaging or Allet, tend to use copolymer PP with UV stabilizers as their default. It's just the standard engineering expectation in that market. The European standards help here. European storage bins often carry DIN55423 or EN12503 ratings. These are specific test standards for stackability and impact resistance. The heavy-duty rating under DIN55423 requires a bin to survive a 1.5 meter drop onto concrete at negative 20 Celsius with a 25 kilogram load with no cracks longer than 5 millimeters.
That's a brutal test. Drop a loaded bin from chest height onto frozen concrete.
If it passes, it gets a rating. American bins rarely carry comparable certifications. The standards exist. ASTM has equivalents, but American manufacturers generally don't test to them for consumer products. So when you see a European bin with DIN55423 heavy duty on the spec sheet, that's not marketing. That's a verifiable performance claim.
What's the Buy It For Life shortlist, then? If someone wants to stop messing around and just buy bins that will outlast them...
Really useful boxes out of the UK. Copolymer PP, UV stabilized, ribbed lids, 5-knuckle living hinges, stackable with lid locks. The 35-liter version weighs 1.8 kilograms and costs about $22. That's the gold standard for consumer accessible storage. Rocco out of Denmark. They use glass-filled nylon for their extreme duty stuff, which is a whole different league. Sortimo out of Germany. They make the K41 box for automotive technicians. Impact modified PP with 15% talc filler. The talc adds stiffness without brittleness. Those boxes survive daily drops from 2 meters onto concrete for over a decade in professional workshops.
15% talc, so literally adding rock dust to the plastic to make it stiffer.
Talc, calcium carbonate, sometimes glass fibers. They increase stiffness and heat deflection temperature. The trade-off is they can reduce impact strength, which is why you pair them with impact modifiers. It's a balancing act. The Sortimo box uses PPC Plus, Talc Plus UV Stabilizer. That's 3 separate engineering decisions that each cost money and each solve a specific problem.
The spec sheet for a truly great bin would read something like PPC, hull is stabilized, 15% talc filled, injection molded, with a ribbed lid and a 5-knuckle living hinge.
That's the dream spec. You're not going to find all of that at Walmart, but you can get close. The really useful box hits most of those points. Copolymer PP, UV stabilized, good hinge design, ribbed lid. The talc filler is the one thing it doesn't have, and for home storage, you probably don't need it.
Let's do the cost math, because I think that's what convinces people.
A $22 really useful box that lasts 20 years costs you $1.10 per year. A $12 Sterilite bin that lasts 3 years costs you $4 per year. The expensive bin is actually 3.6 times cheaper over its lifespan, and that's before you factor in the annoyance of discovering your bin cracked and your stuff is covered in garage dust.
Or the cost of driving to IKEA again to buy another Samla.
Which is its own kind of environmental impact. People think buying cheap plastic is somehow less wasteful, but replacing it 4 times over 20 years means 4 times the manufacturing energy, 4 times the shipping, 4 times the landfill volume.
The environmental argument for buying better plastic is actually straightforward. One bin that lasts is less destructive than 4 bins that don't.
That's the counterintuitive part. The plastic is bad. Instinct pushes people toward the cheapest option because they feel guilty buying plastic at all. But the cheapest option is the one that fails fastest and gets replaced most often. If you're going to use plastic, and for modular storage, it's genuinely the best material for the job. You should use the plastic that stays in service the longest.
What about the recycling number itself? I think a lot of people assume the little triangle tells them everything they need to know.
That's another misconception. The number 5, polypropylene, covers everything from the most brittle homopolymer to the toughest impact copolymer. The number alone is nearly useless for durability assessment. It tells you the polymer family, not the grade, not the additives, not the processing method. 2 bins can both say 5 PP on the bottom, and one will shatter in a cold garage while the other survives a decade of abuse.
The triangle is a starting point, not an answer.
It's the first clue. Number 2, HDPE, is actually a great material for bins too. Good impact resistance, good chemical resistance, but it has poor UV stability without additives, and it's harder to mold with living hinges. You see HDPE more in detergent bottles and milk jugs than in storage bins with attached lids. Number 5, PP dominates the storage bin market because of that hinge performance.
Are there any other numbers we should care about? Number 1, PET. Number 4, LDPE.
PET, number 1, is soda bottle plastic. High clarity, good barrier properties, but terrible for structural applications. It stress cracks easily and has essentially no fatigue resistance. LDPE, number 4, is flexible and tough in film form, like garbage bags, but is too soft for rigid bins. You'll see it in squeeze bottles and flexible lids, not in structural storage. Number 3, PVC is rarely used for storage bins because it's heavy, hard to recycle, and releases hydrochloric acid if you burn it. Number 6, polystyrene is the brittle stuff. CD cases, disposable cutlery. Absolutely not for storage bins. Number 7 is other. Could be polycarbonate, could be nylon, could be anything. You're not likely to find storage bins in number 7.
Practically speaking, you're looking for a number 5 with a C after it, or at least some indication that it's copolymer.
That C, C, PPC, or PP impact copolymer is more common on European spec sheets. American manufacturers often don't bother specifying, but you can infer it from the flex test. If the plastic stress whitens when you bend it, it's almost certainly copolymer with impact modifier.
Let's talk about the clear bin problem, because I see a lot of garages lined with clear bins, and people think they're making a smart choice because they can see what's inside.
That visibility comes at a cost. Clear polypropylene has no carbon black, and unless the manufacturer specifically added HALS, which most don't, because clear bins are positioned as indoor products, the UV transmission goes right through the plastic and degrades it from the inside out. The bin looks fine for the first year, then it starts yellowing, then the surface gets chalky, and then one day you grab it by the handle and the handle snaps off in your hand.
Clear bins in a garage with windows are on borrowed time.
If you need visibility, use clear bins, but keep them in a dark closet. If they're going in the garage, use opaque bins, ideally black, dark gray, or dark green. The pigment is doing real protective work.
What about the big box store brands specifically? You mentioned Sterilite. What are people actually getting when they buy a 27-gallon Sterilite latch box?
Sterilite is interesting because they use copolymer PP in some of their products, including that 27-gallon latch box, but they don't UV stabilize. So you're getting good impact resistance, decent hinge life, but no sunlight protection. If you keep that bin in a dark basement, it'll last a decade. If you put it in a sunny garage, you've got maybe 5 years before the lid starts to go. Rubbermaid is similar. Their Roughneck line uses HDPE, which has good impact resistance. But the lids are often homopolymer PP, and they crack at the corners. Iris, the Japanese brand, uses higher-grade PP in their USA-made bins, but their imported stuff varies.
Brand alone isn't a guarantee. You have to look at the specific product.
Sterilite makes some bins that are good for the price and some that are disposable. The difference is in the material choices, and the only way to know is to check the flex test, check the weight, and if possible, check the spec sheet.
You mentioned European standards earlier. Is there an American equivalent to DIN 55423 that people should look for?
ASTM has D4168 for plastic bins, but it's less commonly cited on consumer products. Market is just less standardized for consumer storage. Industrial bins, things like Acro Mills or Quantum Storage Systems, they'll list ASTM specs. But for the bins you buy at Target, you're mostly on your own.
Which is why we're doing this episode.
The information exists, it's just not presented to consumers in a useful way. You have to know what to look for.
Let's build the checklist then. If someone's standing in the aisle or scrolling Amazon, what are the 5 things they should check?
Number 1, look for copolymer PP or PPC in the description. If it just says polypropylene with no modifier, assume it's homopolymer. Number 2, check the weight. Pick it up. If it feels flimsy for its size, it is. Divide the price by the weight in kilograms. If it's under $10 per kilo, you're probably looking at thin-walled homopolymer. Number 3, flex the lid edge. If it stress whitens, you've got impact modifier and you're in good shape. If it cracks immediately, put it back on the shelf.
The bend test.
Number 4, look for UV stabilizer mention. UV resistant, UV stabilized, or specifically HALS stabilized. If it's not there, assume the bin is indoor only. Number 5. Avoid clear bins for any location that gets sunlight. Opaque is better. Black or dark colors are best.
The bonus rule, if the bin costs less than a burrito, it's not a bin. It's a temporary container.
That's a good heuristic. If you're paying $6 for a 50-liter bin, the manufacturer spent maybe $1.50 on materials. There's no room in that budget for copolymer PP, HALS stabilizers, or impact modifiers. You're buying homopolymer PP with the minimum wall thickness required to survive shipping.
What about the lid locks and latches? I've had those snap off on cheaper bins.
Latch design is another spec sheet tell. Good bins use a cam over latch that distributes force across a wide area. Cheap bins use a simple snap fit that concentrates stress on a tiny plastic tab. That tab is almost always homopolymer PP, and it's the first thing to fail. Look for latches that are thick with a smooth locking action. If the latch feels like it's going to snap every time you close it, it eventually will.
I've had bins split down the side when they were loaded with books.
Sidewall splitting is a classic weld line failure. The plastic met itself at the corner during injection molding, didn't fully fuse, and a crack propagated from that weak point under load. You can spot potential problems by looking at the corners. If you see a visible line or a slight indentation where the plastic flows met, that's the weld line. In a good bin, it's barely visible. In a cheap bin, you can feel it with your fingernail. That's a stress riser waiting to become a crack.
You're inspecting the corners for visible seams.
Run your finger along the inside corner. If it feels smooth and uniform, good. If you feel a ridge or a groove, that's where it's going to fail.
What about the stacking lugs? The little bumps and recesses that let bins stack?
Those are load transfer points. Good bins have deep, well-defined stacking features that lock the bin above into place and prevent it from sliding. Cheap bins have shallow nubs that sort of vaguely suggest alignment but don't actually secure anything. If you stack three bins and the whole tower wobbles, the stacking features are cosmetic, not functional.
We've talked a lot about polypropylene. Is there any case for HDPE bins?
HDPE has some advantages. It's naturally more impact-resistant than homopolymer PP at room temperature. It has better chemical resistance. If you're storing solvents or harsh cleaners, HDPE is the better choice. But it's softer, so it scratches more easily. And it doesn't do living hinges well. HDPE fatigues faster under repeated flexing. So you typically see HDPE bins with separate detached lids rather than attached hinge lids. The Rubbermaid Roughneck Totes are HDPE, and they're legendary for surviving abuse. But the lids are a separate piece, and they eventually warp.
The separate lid is a design choice driven by the material limitation.
You can't have a durable living hinge in HDPE, so you don't design one. You make a snap-on lid instead. That lid will eventually stop snapping on, usually because it warps from heat or UV exposure. But the bin itself might be fine. So you end up with a perfectly good bin and a useless lid. That's a different failure mode, but it's still a failure mode.
What about the future of all this? Bioplastics are coming, PLA, PHA. Are they going to match copolymer PP for durability?
Early data says no. PLA, polylactic acid, is compostable under industrial conditions, but it's brittle and has terrible impact resistance. It also hydrolyzes. It absorbs moisture from the air and degrades. A PLA bin in a damp basement might start breaking down in under 2 years, even without sunlight. PHA is better. It's produced by bacteria, and it's more flexible than PLA, but it's still nowhere near the durability of copolymer PP. The trade-off between biodegradability and longevity is real. You can have a bin that lasts 20 years, or you can have a bin that breaks down in a landfill. You can't have both with current technology.
The environmental calculus is weird. A bioplastic bin that falls apart in 2 years might have a higher total footprint than a copolymer PP bin that lasts 20, because you're replacing it 10 times.
That's the conversation nobody in the banned plastic camp wants to have. Durability is an environmental virtue. The longest lasting product is often the least wasteful, even if the material is synthetic.
There's also the EU's proposed right to repair legislation that might apply to plastic products. What would that mean for storage bins?
If it goes through, manufacturers would have to publish material specs, which would be huge for consumers, and sell replacement parts separately. Replacement lids, replacement latches, replacement wheels for rolling bins. Right now, if your bin lid cracks, you throw away the whole bin even though the base is perfectly fine. That's insane from a materials perspective. If you could buy a $10 replacement lid for your really useful box, that $22 bin might last 40 years.
The spec sheet literacy we're talking about today becomes even more valuable if that legislation passes. You'd be able to look at a bin, understand exactly what it's made of, and know that you can keep it running indefinitely with replacement parts.
You choose bins from manufacturers who commit to that. Sortimo already sells replacement lids and handles for their professional boxes. Really Useful Boxes has some replacement parts available. That's a signal. A manufacturer who sells replacement parts is confident their product is worth repairing.
All right, let's land this. Someone's about to reorganize their garage. They've got $100 to spend on bins. What's the play?
If you're in the US and you want something you can buy locally, the Sterilite 27-gallon latch box, it's copolymer PP, decent hinge design, about $12 to $15. Keep it out of sunlight and it'll serve you well. If you can order online, get the Really Useful Box 35-liter or 64-liter. Yes, they're more expensive up front. Yes, you might need to order them from a specialty supplier, but you'll never buy those bins again. If you're in Europe, you have more options. Rayako, Alit, Auer, Sortimo. You can buy bins that will outlast your grandchildren.
The one-sentence summary for the person who doesn't want to remember all the chemistry.
Look for copolymer PP, UV stabilization, and a lid that stress whitens when you bend it. And remember that a $20 bin that lasts 20 years is cheaper than a $10 bin you replace every 3.
Plastic isn't the problem. Ignorance of plastic is the problem. Buy better, buy once.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
Lightning striking sand or soil can form fulgurite, a hollow glass tube that preserves the path of the electrical discharge. In the 1980s, researchers studying fulgurites from Nunavut found that the glass walls contain tiny acoustic cavities that, when struck, produce a frequency signature matching the exact duration of the original lightning strike, essentially a frozen sound wave in glass.
A frozen sound wave in glass. That's going to sit with me for a while. This has been My Weird Prompts. Our producer is Hilbert Flumingtop. If this episode saved you from buying one crappy bin that cracked on you, leave us a review and tell us about the bin that finally broke you. We're at My Weird Prompts.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth's slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.